but the sand was too yielding to knock him out. Standing, Kylar drew his sword. The sounds of Logan moaning and his own heavy breathing seemed to be the only sounds in all the world. The stadium was silent. There wasn't even any wind. It was hot, so damned hot. Kylar slashed viciously across Logan's left kidney and then his right. The sword was warded, so it didn't cut, of course, but it was still like getting smacked with a cudgel. Logan cried out in pain. He sounded suddenly so young. Despite his huge body, Logan was barely 18, but the sound embarrassed Kylar. It was weakness. It was humiliating, infuriating. Kylar looked around the stadium. Somewhere, the nine were here, watching, each dressed as an ordinary man, pretending to share his neighbor's horror, pretending to be friends with men they despised, men they would betray for nothing more than money. There was a noise behind Kylar, and he saw Logan had fought to his hands and knees. He was struggling to stand. His face was bleeding from 100 tiny cuts from the sand, and his eyes were unfocused. Kylar lofted his glowing orange sword to the crowd. Then he spun and smashed the flat of the blade into the back of Logan's head. His friend crumpled, unconscious, and the crowd gasped. Humiliating Logan had been the only way to save him, but humiliation served in such a dishonorable manner would not draw attention to Logan's defeat, but instead to the Sakage. They were vile and shameless and omnipotent. And today, Kylar was their avatar. He tossed the red sword down and raised his hands to the crowd once more, this time in dual one-fingered salutes. To hell with all of you. To hell with me. Then he ran. Chapter 27. The Modaini Smoking Club's windows were Plangen plate glass cut into wedges and fanciful zoomorphic shapes. If you looked at the shapes in the glass, you could ignore the outside world completely, which was the point. If you looked at the shapes, you wouldn't notice the bars on the other side of the window. Kylar stood at that window, staring through those bars at the girl down in the Sidlin market. She was bargaining with a vendor for produce. Doll girl, Eline, was growing up, perhaps 15 years old, now that Kylar was 18. She was beautiful, at least from this safe distance. From here he could see her body, supple curves, clad in a simple serving dress, her hair pulled back and shining gold in the sun, and the flash of an easy smile. Though he couldn't make out her scars from this distance, through the colored glass, her white dress was blood red. The leaded zoomorphic whorls reminded him of the whorls of her scars. "She'll destroy you," Mama Kay said behind him. "She's part of a different world from any you'll ever know."
"I know,"
he said quietly, barely glancing over his shoulder. Mama Kay had come into the room with a new girl, an East Side girl, young and pretty. Mama Kay was combing the girl's blonde hair out. The Modaini Smoking Club was very different from most of the brothels in the city. The courtesans here were trained in the arts of conversation and music as much as the arts of the bedchamber. There was no scandalous dress, no nudity, no groping in the public areas, and no commoners allowed. Mama Kay had found out about Kylar's excursions long ago, of course. You couldn't keep anything secret from Mama Kay. She'd argued with him about it, and still made her comments whenever she happened to be here. But once she'd found out that he wouldn't stop coming, she made him swear that he came into the smoking club and watch from inside. If he was going to be stupid, she said, he might as well be safe. If he went outside, sooner or later he'd bump into the girl and talk to her, and bed her, and fall in love with her, and get himself killed for his defiance. Don't be shy, Mama Kay said to the girl. You're soon going to be doing a lot more while a man's in the room than changing your clothes. Kylar didn't turn as he heard the sounds of clothes being shed. Just what he needed. He was depressed already. I know it's scary your first time, Daedra, Mama Kay said gently. It's a hard business. Isn't that right, Kylar?
It had better be. It doesn't do much when it's soft.
Daedra giggled, more from her nerves than Kylar's cleverness, no doubt. He didn't turn from the barred window. He was soaking his eyes in Eline. What would her clear brown eyes say as she looked at the girl behind him, preparing for her first client?
You're going to feel guilty at first, Daedra, Mama Kay said. Expect it. Ignore it. You're not a slut. You're not a liar. You're an entertainer. Men don't buy a fine Sethi wine because they're thirsty. They buy it because it makes them feel good, and buying it makes them feel good about themselves. That's why they come here, too. Men will always pay for their vices, whether it's wine, or lifting your skirt, or murder, Kylar said, touching the full coin purse and the dagger at his belt. He could almost feel a chill in the air, but Mama Kay ignored him and continued on. The secret is to decide what you won't sell. Never sell your heart. Some girls won't kiss. Some won't be kept by one man. Some won't perform certain services. I did it all. But I kept my heart.
Did you? Kylar said.
Really?
He turned, and his heart jumped into his throat. Through Mama Kay's art, Daedra now looked identical to Eline. Similar build, similar glorious curves, the same glowing gold hair, the same simple servant's dress, similar to everything, but that she was on this side of the bars, close enough to touch. And Eline was out there. Daedra had an uncertain smile, like she couldn't believe how he was talking to Mama Kay. Mama Kay was furious. She swept across the room and grabbed Kylar's ear like he was a naughty little boy. She hauled him out of the room by his ear into the second-story landing. It was full of overstuffed chairs and fine rugs, with a bodyguard sitting in one corner, and doors leading to four different courtesans' rooms. Stairs led down to a parlor lined with suggestive, but not explicit paintings, and leather-bound books. Mama Kay finally released his ear, and closed the door behind her quietly.
"Damn you, Kylar! Daedra is terrified already. What the hell are you doing?"
"Telling an ugly truth," he shrugged. "Telling lies, whatever.
If I wanted truth, I'd look in a goddamn mirror. This life isn't about truth. It's about making the best of what you've got. This is about that girl, isn't it? That madness. You saved her, Kylar. Now let her go. She owes you everything."
"She owes me her scars."
"You're a damned fool. Have you ever looked at what's happened to all the other girls in your guild? Not even 10 years out, they're drunks and riot weed smokers, cut purses and cripples, beggars and cheap whores, 15-year-old mothers with starving children, or unable to bear children at all, because they've used tansy tea so many times. I promise you, Eline's not the only girl from your guild with scars given to her by some twist. But she is the only one with a hope and a future. You gave her that, Kylar.
I should have.
The only thing you could have done better was murder that boy earlier, before he did anything to you. If you'd been the kind of child capable of murder, you wouldn't have been the kind of boy who cared what happened to some little girl. The truth is that even if they were your fault, Eline's scars are a small price for the life you've given her.
Kylar turned away. The landing had a window, overlooking the market, too. It was simple glass, clear, neither cut nor colored like the glass in the courtesan's room. It, too, was barred, though with simple straight iron, the bar's edges as sharp as one of Blint's knives. Eline had come closer, and he could see her scars. But then she smiled, and her scars seemed to disappear. How often did girls in the Warren smile like that? Kylar found himself smiling in response. He felt lighter than he could ever remember. He turned and smiled at Mama Kay. I wouldn't have expected to find absolution from you. She didn't smile back.
It's not absolution. It's reality. And I'm the perfect person to give you that. Besides, you carry guilt as badly as Durzo.
Durzo? Durzo never feels guilty about anything, Kylar said.
A flicker of disgust passed over her face. She turned to look at Eline. End this farce, Kylar.
What are you talking about?
Durzo told you the rules. You can fuck, but you can never love. He doesn't see what you're doing, but I do. You believe you love Eline, so you won't fuck at all. Why don't you get this out of your system?
Her voice got gentle.
Kylar, you can't have that girl out there. Why don't you take what you can have?
What are you talking about?
Go into Daedra. She'll thank you for it.
It's on the house. If you're worried because you're inexperienced, she's a virgin too.
Two? Gods! Did Mama Kay have to know everything?
No, Kylar said. No thanks. I'm not interested.
Kylar, what are you waiting for? Some glorious soul union with that girl out there? It's just fucking. And that's all you get. That's the deal, Kylar, and you knew it when you started.
We all make our deals.
I did. Durzo did. And you did, too.
Giving up, Mama Kay gestured to one of her bashers downstairs to let a client through. A hairy-knuckled slob wheezed his way up the stairs. Though richly dressed, he was fat and ugly and foul-smelling and grinning broadly with black teeth. He paused on the landing, licking his lips, a slack-jawed picture of lust. He nodded to Mama Kay, winked conspiratorially at Kylar, and went into the virgin courtesan's room.
Maybe they were bad deals, Kylar said. It doesn't matter. There's no going back.
Chapter 28. Fir Kusat knocked on a door high inside the Great Pyramid of Shosendi. Two knocks. Pause. Two. Pause. One. When he and Dorian and Solon had been students at the Magi's School of Fire, they hadn't rated such prestigious rooms. But he and Dorian hadn't been given the rooms now so much to thank them for their historic services as to keep an eye on them. The door cracked open, and Dorian's eye appeared on the other side. Fir always thought it was funny
Dorian was a prophet. He could foretell the fall of a kingdom or the winner of a horse race, a lucrative trick when fear could convince him to do it. But he couldn't tell who was at his own door. He said that prophesying concerning himself involved spiraling uncomfortably close to madness. Dorian ushered Fear inside and barred the door behind him. Fear felt himself passing through an improbably high number of wards. He looked at them. A ward against eavesdropping, he'd expected. A ward against entry was unusual to maintain when you were in the throne room yourself. But the truly strange one was a ward to keep magic in. Fear fingered the threads of the weave, shaking his head in astonishment. Dorian was the kind of magus born once a generation. After studying at Hoth Selar, the healer's school on Gandu, and mastering all they had to teach him by the time he was 16, Dorian had come to the School of Fire and mastered fire magics while not even pretending to be interested in them. He'd only stayed because he'd become friends with Fir and Solon. Solon's talents were almost solely in fire, but he was the strongest of the three. Fir wasn't sure why the two had become friends with him. Maybe because he wasn't threatened by their excellence. They were so obviously the kind of men who'd been touched by the gods that Fir didn't even think to be jealous for a long time. Maybe it helped that he'd been born a peasant. It probably also helped that, whenever he was struggling with his studies and started to be jealous, one or the other of his friends would suggest sparring with him. Fir looked fat, but he could move, and he trained daily with the Blade Masters, who kept their central training facility mere minutes from Shosendi. For Solon or Dorian to volunteer to spar with him was to volunteer for bruises. Dorian could heal bruises later, but they still hurt. Dorian had half-packed saddlebags open on the bed. Fir sighed.
"You know the Assembly's forbidden you to leave. They don't care about Cenaria. Honestly, if Solon weren't there, I wouldn't either. We could send him a message to leave."
The school's leaders hadn't phrased it that way, of course. They were more worried about delivering the content of Midcryu's only, perhaps the world's only, prophet into the God-King's hand.
"You don't even know the best part yet,"
Dorian said, grinning like they were children. Fir felt the blood draining from his face. The wards to keep magic in the room suddenly made sense.
"You aren't planning to steal it?"
"I could make the argument that it's ours. The three of us were the ones who tracked it, found it, and brought it back. They stole it from us first, Fir."
"You agreed it would be safer here. We let them take it from us."
"So I'm taking it back,"
Dorian said, shrugging.
"So it's you against all the world again?"
"It's me for all the world, Fir. Will you come with me?"
"Come with you? Is this the madness?"
When Dorian's gift for prophecy had surfaced, one of the first things he'd tried was to tell his own future. He'd learned that no matter what he did, he would go mad one day. Delving into his own future would only hasten that day's arrival.
"I thought you said you had still had a decade or so."
"Not so long now,"
Dorian said. He shrugged like it didn't matter, as if it didn't break his heart. Exactly the way he'd shrugged when he'd asked Solon to go to Cenaria, knowing it would cost Solon Cade's love.
"Before you answer, Fir, know this. If you come with me, you will regret it many times, and you will never again walk the halls of Shosendi."
"You make such a convincing plea,"
Fir said, rolling his eyes.
"You will also save my life at least twice, own a forge, be known throughout the world as the greatest living weaponsmith, have a small part in saving the world, and die satisfied. If not nearly so old as you or I hoped.
Oh, that's better,
Fia said sarcastically, but his stomach was doing flips. Dorian rarely told what he knew, but when he did, he never lied.
Just a small part in saving the world?
Fia, your purpose in life isn't your happiness. We're part of a much bigger story, everyone is. If your part is unsung, does that make it worthless? Our purpose on this trip isn't to save Solon. It's to see a boy. We will face many dangers to get there. Death is a very real possibility. And do you know what that boy needs from us? 3 words. Maybe 2, if the name counts as only 1. Do you want to know what they are?
Sure.
Ask Mama K.
That's it? What's it mean?
Fi'ir asked.
I have no idea.
Sometimes a seer could be a pain in the ass.
You ask for a lot from me, Fi'ir said.
Dorian nodded.
I'll regret it if I say yes.
Many times. But not in the end.
It might be easier if you told me less.
Believe me, Dorian said, I wish I didn't have such a clear view of what lies before you down each possible choice here. If I told you less, you would hate me for holding back. If I told you more, you might not have the heart to carry on.
Enough!
Gods! Was it going to be that bad?
Fi'ir looked at his hands. He'd have a forge. He'd be known throughout the world for his work. It had been one of his dreams. Maybe he could even marry. Have sons. He thought of asking Dorian, but didn't dare. He sighed and rubbed his temples. Dorian broke into a big smile.
Good. Now, help me figure out how we're going to get Curoc out of here.
Fi'ir was sure he had misunderstood. Then he felt the blood draining from his face. There were wards on the door to keep magic in.
When you say here, you mean here in the school. Like I still have a chance to convince you not to try to steal the most guarded artifact in Midcryu. Right?
Dorian threw back the covers on the bed. There was a plain sheathed sword on it. It looked entirely normal, except that the sheath was made entirely of lead, and it covered the sword entirely, even the hilt, damping the magic. But this wasn't just a magic sword. It was more like the magic sword. This was Curoc, Emperor Jorsan Alkesti's sword, the sword of power. Most magi weren't even strong enough to use it. If Fi'ir, or most others, tried, it would kill him in a second. Dorian had said even Solon couldn't use it safely. But after Jorsan Alkesti's death, there had been quite a few magi who had been able to, and they'd destroyed more than one civilization.
At first, I thought I was going to have to prophesy my own future to get it, but instead,
I prophesied the gods.
Everything worked perfect, except one god came down a hallway that he only had maybe a 1 in 1,000 chance of taking. I had to knock him out. But the good news is, he's going to be nursed back to health by a lovely girl whom he'll later marry.
You're telling me there's some god unconscious upstairs right now just waiting to be found?
While we're talking? Why are you even doing this?
Because he needs it.
He? You're stealing Curoc for Ask Mama K, boy?
the ear asked.
Oh, no. Well, not directly. The boy who needs to hold Kurok, the one the whole world needs to hold Kurok, isn't even born yet. But this is our only chance to take it.
Gods! You're serious?
Fear said. Stop pretending this changes anything. You've already decided. We're going to Sanaria. Sometimes a seer could be a pain in the ass. Try always.
Chapter 29.
What is your problem?
Master Blint screamed.
I don't...
Kylar said.
Again!
Blint roared. Kylar stopped the practice knife with an X-block, crossing his wrists in front of him. He tried to grab Durzo's hand in a twist, but the wet boy slipped aside. They ranged around the practice building of Blint's newest safe house, vaulting off walls, maneuvering each other into beams, attempting to use every uneven edge of the floor against each other. But the match was even. The 9 years Kylar had spent under Blint's tutelage had seen him harden and grow. He was maybe 20 now. He was still not as tall as Blint, and never would be, but his body was lean and taut, and his eyes were the same light, light blue. As he sweated and fought, every muscle in his arms, chest, and stomach was distinct and moving precisely to its task, but he couldn't make himself really engage. Durzo Blint saw it, and it infuriated him. Swearing long and eloquently, Master Blint compared his attitude unfavorably with a lackadaisical prostitute's, his face with unlikely and unhealthy body parts, and his intelligence with several species of farm animals. When he attacked again, Kylar could see him mentally ratcheting up the level. One of the many dangerous things about Master Blint was that even when he was furious, it never showed in his fighting. His fury would only be allowed expression after you were lying on the ground, usually bleeding. He moved Kylar across the open room slowly, hand clenched in fist or extending in knife hand, the practice knife glittering in quick arcs and jabs. For a fraction of a second, he overextended a stab, and Kylar managed to slip around it and hit Master Blint's wrist. But Master Blint held on to the knife, and as he drew it back, the dull blade caught Kylar's thumb. That impatience cost you a thumb, boy. With his chest heaving, Kylar stopped, but he didn't take his eyes off of Master Blint. They'd already practiced with swords of several kinds, with knives of varying lengths. Sometimes they fought with the same weapon, and sometimes they'd mismatch. Master Blint taking a double-edged broadsword against a Gandian blade, or Kylar taking a stiletto against a Gurkha.
Anyone else would have lost the knife, Kylar said.
You're not fighting anyone else.
I wouldn't fight you if you were armed and I wasn't.
Master Blint drew back the knife and threw it past Kylar's ear. Kylar didn't flinch. It wasn't that he didn't still wonder sometimes if Master Blint was going to kill him. It was that he knew he couldn't stop him. When Blint attacked again, it was full speed. Kick met stop kick. Punches were diverted, jabs dodged, blows absorbed against arms, legs, and hips. There were no tricks, nothing showy. Just speed. In the midst of the flashing limbs, as usual, Kylar realized that Master Blint would win. The man was simply better than Kylar. It was usually about now that Kylar would try something desperate. Master Blint would be waiting for it. Kylar unleashed a storm of blows, fast and light as a mountain breeze. None of them alone would hurt Master Blint, even if they connected. But any would cause him to miss the next. Kylar fought faster and faster, each blow being brushed aside,
or only connecting with flesh, tensed for the impact. One low spear hand got through, jabbing Master Blint's abdomen. As he hunched over involuntarily, Kylar went for the full strike on Blint's chin, then stopped. Blint lashed up fast enough that he would have blocked the strike, but with no contact where he'd expected it, he broke the block too far and couldn't bring his hand back before Kylar lashed his still-cocked fist at his nose. But Kylar's strike didn't catch Master Blint. It was brushed aside by an unseen force like an invisible hand. Stumbling, Kylar tried to recover and block Durzo's kick, but it blew through his hands with superhuman force. Kylar smashed into the beam behind him so hard that he heard it crack. He dropped to the ground. "Your turn," Blint said. "If you can't touch me, I'll have a special punishment for you." "Special punishment?" "Beautiful." Hunched on the ground with both arms throbbing, Kylar didn't answer. He stood, but when he turned, in Blint's place stood Logan. But the sneer on Logan's face was all Durzo Blint. It was an illusion. An illusion 7 feet tall, matching Blint's moves precisely. Kylar kicked viciously at his knee, but his foot went right through the figure, shattering the illusion and touching nothing at all. Blint stood 2 feet behind it. As Kylar staggered off balance, Blint raised a hand. With a whoosh, a phantom fist shot from his hand and knocked Kylar off his feet. Kylar bounced back to his feet in time to see Blint leap. The ceiling was 12 feet high, but Blint's entire back hit it and stuck to it. He started crawling and then disappeared as shadows writhed over him and merged with the greater darkness of the ceiling. First, Kylar could hear Blint moving to a spot above him. Then, the sound cut off abruptly. Blint's talent was covering even the scuffing sound of brushing against wood. Moving constantly, Kylar searched the ceiling for any shadow out of place. "Scarred rabble can even throw his voice, or any other sound," Blint said from the far corner of the ceiling. "I wonder if you could." Kylar saw, or thought he saw, the shadow moving back toward him. He flung a throwing knife at the shadow, and it burst apart, leaving his knife quivering in the wood. It was another illusion. Kylar turned slowly, trying to hear the slightest sound out of place over the pounding of his heart. The slight brush of cloth hitting the floor behind him made him spin and lash out, but there was nothing there except Blint's tunic in a pile on the floor. A thump announced Blint himself landing behind Kylar. Kylar spun once more, but something caught his left hand, then his right. Master Blint stood bare-chested, a dead look in his eyes, his real hands at his sides. Kylar's wrists were held in the air by magic. Slowly, his arms were pulled apart until he was spread-eagled. Then further. Kylar held his silence for as long as he could, then screamed as he felt his joints on the verge of dislocating. The bonds dropped, and Kylar crumpled, defeated. Durzo shook his head in disappointment, and Kylar attacked. His kick slowed as it approached Durzo's knee, as if it were sinking into a spring, then bounced back, spinning him hard and throwing him in a tangle to the floor. "Do you see what just happened?" Durzo asked. "You kicked my ass again," Kylar said. "Before that, I almost hit you," Kylar said. "You fooled me, and you would have destroyed me. But I used my talent, and you still refuse to use yours." "Why?"
Because I'm broken. Since meeting Drissa Nile 4 years ago, Kylar had thought 100 times about telling Durzo Blint what she'd told him. He didn't have a conduit, and it couldn't be fixed. But the rules had always been clear. Kylar became a wet boy, or he died. And as Blint had just proved again, Kylar wouldn't be a wet boy without the talent. Telling Blint the truth had always seemed like a quick way to die. Kylar had tried everything to get his talent to work or to learn about anything that might help, but had found nothing. Blint breathed deeply. When he spoke again, his voice was calm. "It's time for some truth, Kylar. You're a good fighter. Deficient still with pole arms and clubs and crossbows and..." He was starting to lecture, but noticed it. "Regardless, you're as good at hand-to-hand fighting and with those Sioran hand-and-a-half swords you like as any fighter I've seen. Today you would have had me. You won't win next time, but you'll start winning. Your body knows what to do, and your mind has got it mostly figured out, too. In the next few years, your body will get a bit faster, a bit stronger, and you'll get cleverer by half. But your weapons training is finished, Kylar. The rest is practice." "And?" Kylar asked. "Follow me. I've got something that may help you." Kylar followed Blint to his workroom. This one was smaller than the one Azoth had first seen in Blint's old safe house, but at least this house had doors between the animals' pens and the work area. It smelled much better. It was also familiar now. The books lining the shelves were like old friends. He and Blint had even added dozens of recipes to them. In the past 9 years, he had come to appreciate Blint's mastery of poisons. Every wet boy used poisons, of course. Hemlock and bloodflower and mandrake root and ariamu were all local and fairly deadly. But Blint knew hundreds of poisons. There were entire pages of his books crossed out, notes sprawled in Durzo's tight, angular hand. "Fool. Dilutes the poison." Other entries were amended, from how long it took for the poison to take effect, to what the best methods for delivery were, to how to keep the plants alive in foreign climates. Master Blint picked up a box. "Sit." Kylar sat at the high table, propping his elbow on the wood and holding his chin. Blint upended the box in front of him. A white snake slid onto the table with a thump. Kylar barely had time to register what it was before it struck at his face. He saw its mouth open, huge, fangs glittering. He was moving back, but too slowly. Then the snake disappeared, and Kylar was falling backward off the stool. He landed flat on his back, but bounced up to his feet in an instant. Blint was holding the snake behind his head. He had grabbed it out of the air while it was striking. "Do you know what this is, Kylar?"
"It's a white asp."
It was one of the most deadly snakes in the world. They were small, rarely growing longer than a man's forearm, but those they bit died within seconds. "No. It's the price of failure. Kylar, you fight as well as any non-talented man I've ever seen. But you're no wet boy. You've mastered the poisons. You know the techniques of killing. Your reaction speed is peerless. Your instincts are good. You hide well, disguise well, fight well. But doing those things well is shit. It's nothing. An assassin does those things well. That's why assassins have targets. Wet boys have debtors. Why do we call them debtors? Because when we take a contract, the rest of their short lives is a formality. You have the talent, Kylar. But you aren't using it. Won't use it. You've seen a little of what I have to teach you, but I can't teach it to you until you tap your talent.
I know,
Kylar said, refusing to meet his master's gaze.
The truth is, Kylar, I didn't need an apprentice when you came along. Never did. But I heard a rumor that an ancient artifact was hidden in Cenaria, the Silver Kakari. They say Ezra the Mad himself made it. It's a small silver ball, but when you bond it, it makes you impervious to any blade, and it extends your life indefinitely. You can still be killed any way that doesn't involve metal, but immortality, Kylar. And then you came along. Do you know what you are? Did that Maja, Drissa Nile, tell you?
Durzo knew about Drissa Nile?
She said I was broken.
The Kakari were made for people broken like you are. There's supposed to be an attraction between people who are vastly talented but don't have a conduit and the Kakari. You were supposed to call it, Kylar. You don't know how to bond it, so you'd call it, hand it over, and I'd be immortal. And I'd still be broken, Kylar said bitterly. Once I had it, we could have Drissa study it. She's a great healer. Even if it took her a few years, it would have been fine. But we're running out of time, Durzo said. Do you know why I can't just let you be an assassin?
Even now he sneered. Kylar had wondered 100 times, of course, but he'd always figured it was because Blint's pride wouldn't let him have a failed apprentice.
Our talent allows us to swear a magically binding oath of service to the Shinga. It keeps the Shinga safe, and it keeps us above suspicion. It's a weak compulsion, but to break it, a wet boy would have to submit himself to a mage or a meister, and all the mages in this city work for the Sakage, and only an idiot would submit to a meister. You've become a skilled assassin, Kylar, and it's making the Shinga nervous.
He doesn't like being nervous.
Why would I ever do anything against the Shinga? It would be signing my own death warrant.
That's not the point. Shingas, who aren't paranoid, don't live long.
How could you never tell me all this? Kylar demanded. All the times you've beaten me for not using my talent, it's like beating a blind man because he can't read.
Your desperation to use your talent is what calls the Kakari.
I was helping you, and I'm going to help you some more.
He gestured to the snake in his hand.
This is motivation. It's also the kindest poison I know.
Master Blint held Kylar with his eyes.
Getting that Kakari has always been your final test, boy. Get it? Or else.
The air took on a chill.
There it was.
Kylar's last warning. Master Blint put away the snake, collected a few of his weapons, grabbed the bag he already had packed, and picked retribution off its pegs on the wall. He checked the big black blade, then slid it back into its scabbard.
I'm going to be gone for a while, he said.
I'm not coming with you?
You'd get in the way.
Get in the way? The casual way Blint said it hurt almost as much as the fact that it was true.
Chapter 30.
I don't like it, Solon said.
Regnus Gyre stared into the winds that blew his silver hair almost straight back.
The twins were quiet today, so there was only the sound of the wind rushing over the wall. He listened to the wind as if it were trying to tell him something.
After 10 years, a summons, Solon said.
Why would the king do such a thing on the eve of your son's majority?
What's the best reason to gather all your enemies in one place?
Regnus asked, barely raising his voice enough to be heard over the wind. It was still cold, even in late spring. Screaming Winds was never warm. The north wind cut through wool, made a mock of the beards and long hair the men grew to hold some extra iota of heat in.
To smash them, Solon said. Better to smash them before they can gather, Regnus said.
The king knows that I'll do everything in my power to be home for my son's ascendance.
That means traveling fast.
That means a small escort.
Clever of him not to command a small escort, Solon said.
I'd have put such subtlety beyond him.
He's had 10 years to think about this, my friend, and the help of his weasel.
His weasel was Fergund Safasti, a magus who was not exactly Shosendi's finest moralist. Fergund also knew Solon by sight, and would gladly tell the world Solon was a magus if he thought it would cause mischief. Fergund was why Solon had been staying with Regnus year-round, as Logan took more responsibilities at court.
It was, he was beginning to think, a serious mistake.
So, you think they'll attack us on the way? Solon asked.
Regnus nodded into the wind.
I don't suppose I'll be able to convince you not to go? Solon asked.
Regnus smiled, and Solon couldn't help but love the man. For all that it had crippled his house and destroyed any ambitions Regnus might have had for the throne, taking command of Screaming Winds had given Regnus life. There was fire in Regnus Gyre, something fierce and proud like a warrior king of old. His command had clear authority, and the power of his presence made him father, king, and brother to his men. In the simple fight against evil, he excelled, even reveled. The Highlanders of Calador, some of whom had never bowed the knee to any man, were warriors. They lived for war, thought it a disgrace to die in bed, believed the only immortality was immortality through deeds of arms sung by their minstrels. They called Regnus the Rurstock Slagen, the Devil of the Walls. And in the last 10 years, their young men had smashed themselves against those walls, tried to climb them, tried to sneak past them, tried to bribe their way through them, climbed over the twins, and tried to descend on Screaming Winds from behind. Every time, Regnus had crushed them. Frequently, he did it without losing a man. Screaming Winds was made of 3 walls at the 3 narrowest points in the only pass between Cenaria and Calador. Between the walls were killing fields sown thick by Regnus's engineers with caltrops, pits, snares, and deadfalls of rock from the surrounding mountains. Twice, clans had made it past the first wall. The traps had reaped such a harvest of death that none had survived to tell what they found beyond it.
It could be genuine, I suppose, Solon said.
Logan says he has become close friends with the prince.
Maybe this is the prince's influence at work.
I don't think much of that prince, Regnus said.
But he thinks a lot of Logan.
We can hope that the prince takes after his mother.
This may even be her work.
Regnus said nothing. He wouldn't say Nalia's name. Not even now.
Hope for the best.
Plan for the worst? Solon asked.
10 of our best men, extra horses for all of us, and go down the coast road instead of the main road?
No, Regnus said. If they've set 1 ambush, they'll have set 2. We might as well make them play their gambit on open ground.
Yes, sir.
Solon only wished he knew
who the other players were.
You still write letters to that Kaede woman?
Solon nodded, but his body went rigid. His chest felt hollow. Of course the commander would know. A letter sent every week, and never a one received.
Well, if you don't get a letter after this one, at least you'll know it's not because yours are boring.
Regnus clapped a hand on Solon's shoulder. Solon couldn't help but smile ruefully. He didn't know how Regnus did it, but somehow, in his company, it was as easy to face heartbreak as it was to face death. Mama Kay sat on the balcony of an estate that had no business being where it was. Against all tradition and sanity, Roth Grimson's opulent estate had been built in the middle of the Warrens. She didn't like Roth, and never had, but she met few people in her work that she did like. The fact was, she had to deal with Roth because she couldn't afford to ignore him. He was one of the Sakage's rising stars.
Not only was he intelligent, but everything he touched seemed to turn to gold. After the Guild Wars, he had emerged as the guild head of the Red Bashers, and had promptly taken over half of the Warrens. Of course, the Sakage had stepped in, only beginning with Durzo's assassination of Corbin Fishhill, but it had taken years to get things truly settled. There had been, of course, curiosity among the Nine at how Roth had managed his guild so well that they'd claimed so much territory. And Roth obviously hadn't liked her questions, but he'd accepted them. A word from her, and he'd never be on the Nine. Another word, and he'd be dead. He was smart enough to know that. Roth was in his late 20s, a tall, formidable young man who carried himself like a prince among dogs. Close-set blue eyes, dark hair, a penchant for fine clothing, today he wore a gray tunic decorated with the Plangen knotwork that was just coming into fashion, matching breeches, and high boots worked in silver. He wore his black hair lightly oiled, a wavy lock sometimes drooping into his eyes.
"If you ever tire of working for our Master of Coin, you'd do well in one of my brothels.
The men would adore you."
She threw that out just to see how he'd take it. He laughed.
"I'll keep that in mind."
With a wave, he signaled the servants to bring their breakfast. Their little table graced the edge of the balcony, and they sat beside each other. Apparently, Roth wanted her to admire his estate. Probably he was hoping she'd ask him why he'd built here. She didn't want to give him the satisfaction. Besides, she'd already looked into it. The reasons were good enough, she knew. He had some waterfront, which would allow him to do some smuggling, though the dock was too small for high profitability and royal attention. He'd also been able to purchase the land for a pittance, though he'd had to hire so many bashers during the construction, he'd lost the savings. When the poor had been displaced, both the honest and the thieves among them had been eager to steal whatever they could from the fool who would build a manse on their side of the river. The bashers had probably beaten hundreds. Mama Kay knew that they killed at least half a dozen. It was death to be found on Grimson's grounds without permission. The walls were high, lined with crushed glass and metal spikes that stood as pointed shadows in the dawn light. Bashers manned those walls, men who were both efficient and enjoyed their work. None of the locals tried to intrude any more. The amateurs had either already tried and paid the price, or knew of others who had. The professionals knew they could cross Vanden Bridge and find easier pickings. His gardens were beautiful, if given to flowers and plants that kept low to the ground, so that his archers didn't have their killing angles obscured. The splashes of vermilion, green, yellow, and orange of his gardens were a stark contrast against the grays and dingy browns of the Warrens. The servants brought the first course, halved blood oranges with a caramelized sugar crust. Roth opened with a comment on the weather. Not a particularly inspired choice, but Mama Kay didn't expect more. He moved on to commenting on his gardens as the servants brought hot sweetbread. He had the newly rich's irritating propensity for revealing how much things had cost. He should have known that she would be able to tell from the quality of the service and the meal exactly how much he was spending on this estate of his. When would he get to the point? "So, there's going to be an opening on the Nine," Roth said. Abruptly done. He should have divulged an amusing anecdote from his work and used that to lead here. Mama Kay was starting to doubt this one. "Yes," she said. She let it sit. She wasn't going to make this easy. The sun was just rising above the horizon, and the sky was turning a glorious orange. It was going to be a scorching day. Even at this hour, she barely needed the shawl around her shoulders. "I've been working with Phineas Saratson for 6 years. I know the job better than anyone." "You've been working for the Tremeteer, not with him." His eyes flashed, but he said nothing. A dangerous temper, then. Master Grimson didn't like to be corrected. "I think your spies must not be smart enough to have seen the amount of work I do versus what that old man does." She lifted an eyebrow. "Spies? Everyone knows you have spies everywhere." "Well, everyone knows." "It must be so, then." "Oh, I see," Roth said. "It's one of those things everyone knows, but I'm not supposed to mention because it's rude." "There are people within this organization with whom it is dangerous to be rude, boy. If you're asking for my vote, you'd do well to make a friend of me." He motioned to the servants, who took their plates and replaced them with cuts of spiced meats and a lightly broiled egg dish with cheese. "I'm not asking," he said quietly. Mama Kay finished her eggs and began on the braised meat. Delightful. The man must have brought a chef from Gandu. She ate and looked at the lightening sky, the sun rising slowly over the great iron gate to Grimson's estate. If he took that comment back, she'd let him live. "I don't know how you have such influence on the Nine, but I know I need your vote, and I will have it," Roth said. "I will take your vote, or I will take your niece." The meat that a moment ago had seemed so delightfully spiced, that seemed to melt in Mama Kay's mouth, suddenly tasted like a mouthful of sand. "Pretty girl, isn't she? Adorable little braids. It's so sad about her mother dying, but wonderful that she had a rich aunt to find her a place to live, and in the castle itself, no less. Still, a rich old whore ought to have done better than have her niece raised by a serving woman." She was frozen. How did he find out? The ledgers. Her ledgers were done all in code, but Phineas Saratson was the Sakage's master of coin. He had access to more financial records than the next 5 people in the kingdom combined. Roth must have followed the records and found payments made to a serving woman in the castle. She was a frightened woman. A single threat from Roth, and she'd have folded. Roth stood, his plate already empty. "No, do sit. Finish your breakfast." She did, mechanically, using the time to think. Could she spirit the girl away? She couldn't use Durzo for this, but he wasn't the only wet boy she knew. I'm a cruel man, Guinevere. Taking a life is... Roth shivered with remorse.